Good morning. My name is Alyssa Cohen, and I am a junior international relations major. It is my distinct pleasure today to welcome Deborah Liane Fenton to Carleton College. Deborah is the executive director of the U.S. Committee for Human Rights in North Korea. Under her leadership, the committee has been cited as the leading, most credible U.S.-based organization on the issue of human rights in North Korea. Founded in 2001, the committee has undertaken a broad domestic and international grassroots initiative on the human rights issue. Deborah has directed the organization to focus on initiatives that have sustained impact to promote the rights of the North Korean people, particularly women. Deborah testifies regularly before Congress and is a participant in international strategy consortiums on human rights. She is a member of the Senate Foreign Relations Focus Group on North Korean Refugees and the China Task Force sponsored by the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom. Deborah also regularly advises policymakers in the State Department and the Agency for International Development. Prior to joining the Human Rights Committee, Deborah received her bachelor's degree in political science from Trinity College in Hartford, Connecticut. She earned her master's degree in politics, specializing in Southeast Asia, from the School of Oriental and African Studies in London. She directed the U.S. Institutes of Peace First Human Rights Implementation Program and is the editor of Implementing U.S. Human Rights Policy, Agenda, Policies, and Practices. Her work with the media has included international appearances in print, television, and radio outlets, including, but not limited to, CNN, NBC, The New York Times, and Newsweek. With that said, please join me now in welcoming Deborah to Carleton College.
Thanks, Alyssa. On behalf of the committee, I wish to express my gratitude to Carleton College for inviting me to speak today on the subject of human rights in North Korea. I can't think of a better venue in light of Carleton's strong tradition of civic participation and scholarship. Today I've brought a short DVD that provides the visual impetus for how I got involved on this issue. If we can watch just the beginning part of this, I'll then characterize the main aspects of the problem.
It's 10:30 in the morning. The sky is clear. A large crowd has been called out. Midwinter temperatures in this area can drop below minus 30 centigrade. It's the 1st of March, but the bitter cold lingers. Haeryong lies at the northern end of North Korea. Haeryong, which borders China, is a commonly used exit route for escapees leaving North Korea. The crowd has gathered near a loudspeaker van. Uniformed security officers are policemen. Today's event is being carried out under police authority. The railroad bridge spans the Haeryong River, a tributary of Tumen River, which divides North Korea from China. This is the right bank of the river. A nearby market assures easy access by a large crowd. The master of ceremonies announces the trial. He stands on a platform behind the van, and large speakers make sure everyone can hear. The people are here because they were called out, but one of their motives is to check if they know any of the participants in today's trial. Now, the city's chief commissar, the top local government official, addresses the crowd. Today, verdicts will be handed down on 11 defendants. Most are accused of illegal border crossing, or selling women outside the country, or both. Attempting to help others escape from North Korea is risky. If caught, they will be accused of human trafficking.
Thank you. 전에 사장과 총수를 기뻐시고 기분을 올려야 비롯한 온갖 기사주의 현상과 업계 규정을 더욱 강화하듯 결과하게 요구하였습니다. 만일 국경을 자세히 방지하지 못해
The problems in the border area include escapes from North Korea, illegal border crossings, and information flowing in from outside. They jeopardize the current regime. The chief judge of the provincial court announces the verdict.
3절, 조선민주주의 인민공화국이 이름으로서 국회 94, 2005년 3월 1일 삼정국도대판소
These articles stipulate no death penalty. The maximum penalty is life sentence at hard labor. In the middle of the trial, two poles are being set up. Execution preparations are begun even while verdicts are being announced.
2
defendants are sentenced to death. The police will execute them now. Some people turn to leave, unable to witness what is about to happen. They are shot at 11 a.m. sharp, just 22 minutes after the Master of Ceremonies opened the people's trial. The crowd is silent. Many children are also here. Reportedly, in some cases, children have been brought by their teachers. The bodies are loaded into bags and carried away by truck. The executive officers are leaving by car. The audience begins to move. In the crowd, a cluster of people sit on the ground, their heads down. Many are women. According to the authorities, these people are also criminals. As a lesson, they are forced into front row seats at the execution. Out of 11 defendants, 9 escape execution today. They are taken away. In the late 90s, when many were starving, public executions became more common. A typical crime, stealing cows from cooperative farms so families could eat. Since then, executions have been reported less often, probably because of the international outcry protesting them. But now, public executions are back in the towns along the border. This time, the crimes relate to escape from North Korea.
In most of the world, a government's legitimacy, even survival, has become dependent upon a respect for the fundamental rights of its people. Just 30 years ago, the stability and integrity of a government were measured by how well it could control its citizens. Today, the very need to exert such control is a hallmark of instability and desperation. But the people of North Korea have been denied even the most basic of their human rights. They have been denied any contact with the rest of the world, and they have been isolated from each other. Since 1990, despite harsh conditions and consequences, it is estimated that more than 500,000 North Koreans have escaped their homeland, which is against the law. Right now, North Korea is well into its second decade of chronic food shortages. A famine in the 1990s killed as many as 1 million North Koreans, or roughly 5% of the population. Millions more were left to contend with broken lives and personal misery. An understanding of the human rights conditions prevailing in North Korea is essential to grasping the worldview of the governing elite and to appreciating the conditions endured by the people of North Korea. Such an understanding is crucial to developing a long-term strategy for dealing with this country. The last 25 years have demonstrated that to comprehend a government's intentions, human rights performance is a valuable indicator. What I have been asked to do today is to lay out three of the areas of most serious human rights concern regarding North Korea, and to characterize the main aspects of the problem. These are, one, the chronic food shortage crisis afflicting the country, two, the prison camp system, and three, the refugee problem. The information I'm about to provide can also be found in our reports located on our website at www.hrnk.org. The food shortage. The government of North Korea divides the entire society into three classes: core, wavering, and hostile, based on an assessment of loyalty to the regime. As a result, as many as 18 million people are denied equal access to decent education, employment, housing, medical care, and food. As much as 5% of the population died in a famine in the 1990s. The world responded to this tragedy with considerable generosity, committing more than $2 billion in food aid to the country over the past decade. Despite its strained political relations with North Korea, the United States has been the largest donor of humanitarian assistance since 1995, contributing over $600 million in food aid, which is the equivalent to over 2 million metric tons of grain. Yet, according to World Food Program estimates, nearly half of North Korea's 23.7 million do not have enough to eat, and more than a third of the population, nearly 6.5 million North Koreans, is chronically malnourished. Rations from the public distribution system, the PDS, which is the primary source of staple food for more than 70% of the population, have reportedly declined from the already insufficient 319 grams per person per day in 2003 to 250 grams in March 2005. And I brought this along with me. I measured out, this is a little bit more than 250 grams of rice. This is how much food you can get in North Korea if you are deemed loyal to the political apparatus, to Kim Jong-il. If you are not deemed loyal, you don't get even this much rice. North Korea's food problems pose a distinctive set of challenges for the international community. In many humanitarian crises, the international community faces failed states or conflict settings that make it difficult to provide assistance. In North Korea, by contrast, the international community faces a hard state that has repeatedly shown a willingness to allow its population to suffer extreme deprivation. The government also tightly controls access by outsiders. Such a setting raises a number of fundamental and interrelated questions for donors, whether multilateral, bilateral, or non-governmental. Should the international community provide assistance even if it means prolonging the life of a despotic regime? Does aid prolong the very policies that led to the famine in the first place? Should donors provide assistance even if some portion of that assistance is diverted to undeserving groups, including the military and party cadre? If the decision is made to provide assistance, how can donors guarantee that food aid reaches vulnerable groups and achieves other objectives, such as inducing economic reforms or empowering new social groups? These questions are ultimately ethical ones. It is impossible in such a setting to guarantee that all aid is being used appropriately. That is precisely why humanitarian aid to North Korea poses policy and moral dilemmas. One response to this quandary is to conclude erroneously that concerns over human rights and the humanitarian impulse stand in opposition. The separation of humanitarian considerations from a human rights discourse is fundamentally flawed. North Korea's tragedy has many roots, but a famine of this magnitude could only have occurred in a system in which the political leadership was insulated from events on the ground and lacking in accountability to its people. The failure of the North Korean government to guarantee adequate supplies of food to its population is inextricably linked to the government's denial of a battery of rights to its citizens: to confront public officials with their shortcomings, to publicize information that allows government officials to know the extent of distress, and to organize collectively in the face of injustice and deprivation. If these rights were present, North Korea might well have faced food shortages, but it is highly doubtful that a great famine would have occurred, or that the government would be presiding over an economy characterized by chronic food shortages. The famine had profound consequences for North Korean society. Families were forced into coping behaviors such as gathering wild foods like grass, tree bark, and weeds, selling assets, and engaging in various forms of petty trade, barter, and illicit exchange. Faced with this loss of control, the government continued to criminalize the very coping strategies that allowed people to survive and even added new controls. During famines, people travel, either to relocate to a destination where conditions are less severe or to trade. However, all travel within North Korea is controlled and requires permits. Initially, the government relaxed restrictions on internal travel for the purpose of securing food, but undocumented movement remained illegal and thus vulnerable to low-level extortion and corruption. The fundamental right to leave one's country is enshrined in both the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, to which the government of the DPRK, North Korea, is a state party. Nonetheless, the North Korean Penal Code prescribes sentences of up to 3 years in a prison labor camp for unauthorized departure. North Korea experienced severe economic shocks in the early 1990s. A tense standoff with respect to its nuclear weapons program, an uncertain political transition, and a succession of natural disasters. Since October 2002, the country is once again involved in a dispute with the international community over its nuclear weapons ambitions. Each of these circumstances contributed to North Korea's economic isolation and posed severe policy challenges to the government. None of these challenges, however, absolve the government from its most basic of all responsibilities: to guarantee the survival needs of its people. To the contrary, national security arguments ring particularly hollow when the North Korean regime uses them to justify inhumane treatment of its population. The UN's International Covenant on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights, to which they're also a state party, is quite explicit on this point. States have a core obligation to take the necessary action to mitigate and alleviate hunger, even in times of natural or other disasters. A key to resolving the North Korean hunger problem is the development of a functioning economy that generates sufficient foreign exchange earnings to purchase food on a commercial basis, just as its neighbors, Japan, South Korea, and China do. While food security is an understandable national goal, it seldom, if ever, is best achieved through the pursuit of self-sufficiency. Given North Korea's basic endowments, it is highly unlikely that the country is capable of achieving food self-sufficiency. Indeed, the famine and chronic food shortages have proven the point beyond dispute. It is tempting to conclude that solving this most basic problem, achieving the ability to finance adequate imports on a sustainable basis, is the only thing that needs to be done. But the economic reforms required to achieve this objective are only a necessary, not a sufficient, condition for improving access to food. The North Korean food problem is not just a problem of production and capacity to import, but also an issue of distribution and entitlement. Such questions necessarily depend on fundamental features of the political system. North Korea's tragedy could only have occurred in a system in which the political leadership was insulated from events on the ground and shielded from political competition and freedom of association and speech. The arguments in favor of assistance, that's food assistance, seem clear. But one must be simultaneously clear-headed about the nature of the bargains that have been struck. It is likely that aid is not proffered in a non-discriminatory manner. Given the political stratification of North Korea and the inability of the World Food Program to achieve minimum standards of transparency and monitoring in its operations, undeserving households, including politically disfavored households, are not getting the food intended for them or are being denied relief altogether. Our own refugee work confirms this point. Furthermore, diversion is almost certainly occurring, and its scale is not small. If the off-the-record estimates of humanitarian assistance workers are to be believed, perhaps enough food to feed 3 to 10% of the North Korean population is diverted. Some of this aid is consumed by the less deserving. The administrators of the World Food Program have worked in extremely difficult circumstances, even heroically, to assist the people of North Korea. Yet it is critical that within these constraints, the World Food Program continue to not only be the humanitarian face of the international community, but a voice of conscience for those deprived of the most fundamental right to food. Two countries, China and South Korea, provide large amounts of food aid to North Korea outside of the World Food Program. China has not conditioned aid either on overall policy reform or distribution or monitoring practices. In the case of South Korea, food assistance has been provided without any attempt to assess conditions or target vulnerable groups, and with only perfunctory attempts to monitor its distribution. These large, open-ended aid commitments are having the unintended consequence of undermining the World Food Program's attempts to uphold the norms embodied in international agreements to which South Korea is a state party. Special circumstances bind the South and North Korean people together. However, if China and South Korea assume the role of suppliers of last resort, North Korea will be able to avoid greater accountability. What the committee, my organization, has recommended is that both China and South Korea start channeling their aid through the World Food Program, thereby strengthening that mechanism's ability to press for proper monitoring. Prison camps. North Korea runs a vast system of prison camps, for the most part consisting of, one, political labor colonies, or kwanliso, and two, labor camps or penitentiaries called kyohwaso. In the kwanliso, tens of thousands of political prisoners, along with up to three generations of their families, are banished and imprisoned without any judicial process for usually lifetime sentences. Sentences entail slave labor in mining, logging, and farming enterprises in the valleys of mountainous areas in North and North Central North Korea. The kwanliso are described as colonies because they are sprawling encampments 20 or more miles long and 10 to 20 miles wide, containing multiple enclosed self-contained sections or villages for different categories of prisoners. I didn't bring it with me, but in the process of producing our work on prison camps, this was our first report. We got the satellite images of a number of the political prison camps, and we had them annotated by former prisoners. And in this process, we had these massive, this is how large they are, to figure out exactly where these camps were and where the mining happened and where prisoners lived and where the executions were taking place. The posters would span, and these are the images, from that part of the stage all the way to this part of the stage, and we would spread them out on the floor and go through these with these former defectors, and then we of course shrunk them down to size to put into the book, but all of this stuff is on our website if you're interested. There are between 5,000 and 50,000 prisoners per kwanliso, totaling perhaps some 150,000 to 200,000 prisoners throughout North Korea. Both perceived wrongdoers and their extended families are taken or abducted by police authorities and deposited in the kwanliso. without any judicial process or legal recourse whatsoever, for lifetime sentences. The prisoners live under brutal conditions in permanent situations of deliberately contrived semi-starvation. The second component of the North Korean Gulag is a series of smaller labor camps called Kyohwaso. In the Kyohwaso, prisoners are also compelled to perform hard labor, which is slave labor we're talking about here. Under dreadfully harsh conditions, in mining, logging, textile manufacturing, or other industrial projects, such as brick or cement making. However, these prisoners are subjected to a form of judicial process and given fixed-term sentences according to the North Korean Criminal Code, after which they can be released. The majority of Kyohwaso prisoners are imprisoned because they have been convicted of what would be, in any society, felony crimes. But some prisoners are political in that they are convicted for actions that would not be normally criminalized according to international norms. For example, one woman we interviewed described being convicted of disturbing the socialist order for singing in a private home a South Korean pop song. A major phenomenon of repression associated with the Kyohwaso is the shockingly large number of deaths in detention from slave labor under dangerous circumstances and from starvation-level food rations. States, of course, have the right to deprive duly convicted criminals of liberty and remove them from society. States do not have the right to deprive prisoners of their right to food or to work them literally to death. So what is remarkable about the prison camp system in North Korea that really distinguishes it from other countries' methods of punishment is that, one, a person can be put into prison for crimes that would not be considered punishable by the international community. Two, and possibly the most strikingly abnormal characteristic of the prison camp system is the feature of collective responsibility or guilt by association, wherein the mothers and fathers, sisters and brothers, children, and sometimes even grandchildren of the offending political prisoner are also imprisoned in this three-generation arrangement. And three, in the Kwanliso, the presumed offender is simply picked up and taken to an interrogation facility and frequently tortured to confess before being sent to the camp. The family members are also picked up and deposited in a separate camp without ever being told of the whereabouts or wrongdoings of the presumed wrongdoer. North Korea must decriminalize the right to leave and should release all North Koreans who have been detained upon repatriation from China. It should release all those prisoners held in arbitrary detention in the Kwanliso political labor colonies and invite the UN and other international agencies to observe the closings through on-site visits to the locations of the former Kwanliso to confirm that these labor camps are no longer in operation. The brutal mistreatment of convicted prisoners must end. The World Food Program and humanitarian relief organizations should be invited to supply food aid to the prisons, and the International Red Cross should be invited to examine the overall welfare of prisoners. Refugees. North Koreans fleeing deprivation and political oppression in their homeland have no choice but to cross the border into the People's Republic of China. The exact number of North Korean migrants and asylum seekers in China is unknown. The most common estimate is between 100,000 and 300,000, although now people are saying that there are up to 400,000 North Koreans inside China. This estimate is problematic, first because the range itself is so wide, and second because there is no credible publicly available data to support any exact figure. While it is plausible that hundreds of thousands of North Koreans have crossed the border since the advent of the famine in 1994, a significant portion of the movement across the border into China has been and remains back and forth, with North Koreans seeking temporary employment or emergency relief from support networks, then returning to their homes with cash and goods to ensure the survival of their families. It is considered illegal for a North Korean citizen to leave his or her country if it has not been authorized. Article 117 of the 1999 North Korean Criminal Code mandated a punishment of a maximum of 3 years labor re-education for crossing the border without permission. Article 47 of the code stated that one who escapes to another country or to the enemy in betrayal of his motherland and people will receive a punishment of a minimum of 7 years labor re-education. And for serious violations, the mandated sentence is execution and forfeiture of all property. These provisions violate the fundamental right to leave one's own country, a right enshrined both in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, to which North Korea is a state party. Basically, what I've been trying to say is, North Korea, as part of the UN system, has actually signed on to these international human rights protocols, but all of their actions and policies fly in the face of what these tenets put forward. Chinese policy toward North Korean asylum seekers is based on the assumption that all North Koreans crossing the border do so for economic reasons. They are treated as illegal migrants and subject to arrest and deportation. While China is a signatory of the 1951 Convention relating to the status of refugees and its 1967 protocol, as well as being a member of the Executive Committee of the Office of the UN High Commissioner for Refugees, which is the UNHCR, China does not permit the staff of the Beijing office of the UNHCR to travel to the border area to assess the situation for North Koreans in the region. In addition to insisting that all North Koreans are economic migrants, China also justifies its treatment of North Koreans by citing bilateral treaties with North Korea. While hunger may be one motive for movement, there are other realities for North Koreans deciding to leave their country. One, it is the nature of the political system in North Korea, with its discriminatory distribution of resources, that makes feeding a family impossible in some areas. Two, being hungry does not necessarily prevent these people from also being oppressed. Three, the criminal, political, and social persecution that accompanies forcible return to North Korea surely makes these people political refugees once they are in China. The exodus, which increased substantially with the advent of famine in North Korea in the mid-1990s, presents acute humanitarian and human rights dilemmas to, first of all, the government of China, which must assure its security and the integrity of its borders while fulfilling its obligations under the 51 Refugee Convention. To the Office of the UN High Commissioner for Refugees, which is prevented by the Chinese from assessing the situation for North Koreans in China directly. For the government of South Korea, which, while willing to accept North Koreans who reach South Korean consulates as refugees, is not proactive in providing protection for North Koreans in China, for fear of offending the Chinese and North Korean governments. And also the government of the United States, which, while concerned about the situation of North Koreans in China, is unwilling to make their treatment a major point of discussion in their ongoing political and human rights dialogue with the Chinese government. The result is a frustrating stalemate that works to the detriment of North Koreans in China. In response, South Korean and international activists have organized North Korean asylum seekers to attempt to enter embassies in Beijing, which is a very dangerous proposition. There are a number of documentaries that have charted this. One is called Soul Train, and I think they have a website, www.soultrain.com. Which is very good, and I encourage you to have a look at that. And through a global international campaign, have raised awareness of their plight to the point that the United States Congress passed the North Korean Human Rights Act of 2004. The act authorizes substantial U.S. engagement to protect North Korean refugees. This is a positive first step. The success in placing the issue of North Korean asylum seekers on the political agenda will not be matched by success in providing greater protection to North Koreans in China as long as the Chinese government is able to ignore its obligations under the Refugee Convention. With neither South Korea nor the United States willing to stake valuable political capital on an improvement in the situation for North Koreans in China, the only near-term options likely to be effective involve small-scale, quiet changes in the Chinese approach, solutions that provide protection for North Korean asylum seekers while recognizing China's legitimate security concerns. When I think about the human rights situation in North Korea, I am reminded of one of the greatest ideas of the philosopher Confucius regarding the nature of power. He said that there was only one legitimate purpose of power, whether you use it as a leader, as a parent, or simply as a human being. And that is to work for the well-being of the powerless. And that is what I would say is this presentation's call to action. You all have the power to make a difference. I hope at the end of this session, you will be inspired to take action on the issue of human rights in North Korea. The committee has prepared a short list of practical, doable action items that ordinary citizens can undertake to help lend support to the North Korean human rights campaign, and I think this was distributed around right before the talk. While my talk is designed to highlight some of the more serious human rights problems in North Korea, it is important for us to remember that this program isn't designed to be a passive exercise. It is essential to understand that each and every one of us can and has a responsibility to make a difference. We can start by not turning a blind eye to one of the most ugly human rights catastrophes in the world today. Last night, I was staying at the very nice Carleton Alumni Guest House, and there was a book in my room called Carleton College, The First Century. So it was a book about a large volume on the first 100 years of Carleton College. And I was interested, and I flipped it open to the first page, and the first two sentences struck me. It said, "To found a college is an act of faith. To write its history is a labor of love." And I liken that to human rights work. To pursue human rights on behalf of the oppressed, the vulnerable, the powerless, is in many ways an act of faith. And also, we do this work because it's a labor of love. Love for our fellow human beings and for humanity. That's why we do this. I'd like to thank Carleton College again for giving me this opportunity to share information about human rights in North Korea and for your interest and concern on this issue. And I hope that someday I'll have a chance to work with some of you on this campaign. Thank you.
Now we will take a few questions. If anybody has a question, please raise your hand.
Hi, thank you very much. I was wondering, in addition to pressuring China and South Korea to create contingency plans on which their aid rests, would you advocate the U.S. or any Western nation really funneling money and arms into opposition groups in North Korea, if any exist? And essentially, because it seems to me that anything other than a radical political change isn't going to create the necessary changes to increase or better the conditions of the majority of the population. So, like, from a personal perspective, do you think that Kim Jong-il needs to go, and would you advocate regime change instigated by the West, or would you use diplomacy through the UN?
It's an interesting question. The committee and me personally, we are advocating for a diplomatic course toward North Korea, absolutely, for many reasons. I mean, if you look around with other international crises around the world today, that isn't always, you know, a military action is not always the preferred or desirable. It won't yield the desired outcome necessarily. But most importantly, there is no opposition in North Korea. There is no dissent. People are not allowed to think apart from what they are spoon-fed from birth. Anti-U.S. propaganda, anti-Western propaganda, and the deification of Kim Jong-il. And if you think about it, if that's all you are fed from birth, and you grow up thinking all of this, it is very difficult, actually, to think that maybe you have a mind of your own and maybe things aren't so great inside North Korea, when all you're being told is that it is actually paradise inside North Korea. So for lots of reasons, sending weapons into North Korea would be really not a good idea. And I definitely would not advocate for that. But yes, I think that diplomatic avenues have not been fully explored. We put out this report, Failure to Protect, bringing together our work on the food situation and the prison camp system to advocate for the UN Security Council to enact a resolution to devise a strategy of engagement of human rights with North Korea, which we don't have yet. Let's start with diplomacy and engagement on these issues first.
Question here.
Do you think that the treatment of prisoners in the United States, especially at Guantanamo Bay and at the black sites in Eastern Europe, have hurt your cause of making prisoners being treated better in North Korea?
No, not at all. First of all, the committee, my organization is a non-governmental independent human rights group. I think that the maltreatment of prisoners, whether in the United States, in Guantanamo, in Eastern Europe, with rendition programs, in North Korea, or anywhere in the world, is wrong and should be stopped.
A question?
Hi. I was just wondering, I had read some reports on the numbers of refugees that other countries are absorbing, and the numbers of the U.S. were considerably small compared to other European countries, and I was just wondering if you could highlight that problem a little bit.
Yeah. It's been complicated. The U.S. has accepted its first six North Koreans through the Refugee Resettlement Program, actually, just last year. And a lot of that has to do with, I think, first of all, the mechanisms have not been in place in the U.S. government, in the State Department, to be able to assess North Koreans, because in the past, if you're from North Korea, you're considered Korean, which means you can go to South Korea, and South Korea will accept you, not the United States. And so the United States hasn't had a history of taking in North Koreans, but more recently, there has been... they have distinguished North Koreans from South Koreans, and so that now, if a North Korean seeks asylum in the United States, there is some kind of process through which they can go to seek that settlement in the United States. But you're right, the numbers are small.
Another question?
Hi. In one of my classes, we're talking about the effects of sanctions on Burma, and I was wondering if you could talk about the effects of sanctions on North Korea.
Well, people talk, you know, it's interesting, and again, it's very complicated. When people talk about sanctions in North Korea, for a long time, people were complaining that U.S. sanctions toward North Korea was causing all kinds of problems in North Korea, when in fact, all those years, there was only a prohibition against dual-use technology in North Korea. To send dual, like computer technology, for example, to North Korea was prohibited because it could be used for another purpose. But other things weren't. Now the big sanctions are on luxury goods, and this is something that the UN Security Council has enacted with its resolution 1815 of last year because of the nuclear weapons test. The Security Council has now posed stopped all luxury goods being sent to North Korea, and the only people who get luxury goods in North Korea are the regime. And frankly, you know, depriving Kim Jong-il of his cognac and Mercedes-Benz, I don't think is such a bad thing. To go further than that, you know, there are people who complain about economic sanctions against North Korea. The truth is that they're not universal. I think that in the United States there are sanctions imposed on U.S. companies to do business inside North Korea, but not all countries do have economic sanctions with North Korea. So it has, I actually think that it kind of has a limited impact.
But are sanctions an appropriate means of foreign policy?
It's one that, you know, it depends. It's one that I think should be applied while working through other multiple channels, like engagement. There's a diplomatic side, mainly right now through the six-party talks of engagement on the nuclear issue. And I guess it's a carrots and sticks kind of approach. Is the international community going to allow North Korea to continue to test its nuclear weapons, even when asked by its number one supporter and benefactor, China, not to do so? they will do so. They have to know that that will come with costs. They have to be a player in the international community. I think through these talks, what people really want is to bring North Korea in a bit more, and not isolate North Korea, which I think will be for the betterment of North Korea. Sanctions tend to isolate, but with this kind of carrots and sticks approach, maybe something will come out of it. My personal opinion is that you have to just keep on trying with the negotiation process. And I don't just mean on security issues. We don't have enough talking about human rights. In fact, there's no formal process through which human rights is being discussed with North Korea, which is why we are proposing this, that at the highest levels, the UN Security Council is going to engage on human rights issues with North Korea.
Question?
Hi. I'd like to wonder, how do you deal with foreign diplomats or Asian elites who purport the value of Asian values, that the notion that it's a different form of human rights in the world? And how does your committee develop strategies to deal with Asian elites or these people who claim that there's a different set of human rights for both the East and the West? And do you feel that this sort of discourse on sovereignty and Asian values is detrimental to your cause?
I think, you know, that argument has been proposed a while ago, and frankly, I think that it's been debunked. I think that, as a member of the UN system, the Asian countries who are a state party to these many covenants and human rights doctrines are proving, as not only a signatory, but they have ratified. North Korea has actually ratified these major human rights covenants, that in fact, human rights concepts are not just the purview of Western society. They are a pan-human endeavor, and that covers and spans countries, you know, throughout the world. So I don't think that has never been raised, actually, in the 5 years that I've been doing this work with the committee, thankfully. And I think, again, it's because people are agreeing more and more that, yes, this is an internationally recognized concept.
Another question?
I have a question about, do you see any potential of the changes in regime or the political motivation inside of South Korea? And I mean, if you see potential or don't see potential, what would be the historical political motivation or background behind?
Just to clarify, do you mean, do I see any potential for change in the situation in North Korea regarding what happens in the political station in South Korea? Is that what you mean?
It seems that the communist countries, due to the globalization, and then they realize that there is economic incentives to open up their countries or change their political system, or that's more beneficial to their people. Do you see any potential changes inside of North Korea government?
I think so. I'd like to hope so. With the special economic zones. There's a lot of talk about Kaesong right now, which is a special economic zone that is widely publicized. There are North Korean workers and South Korean investment in this area. And there was one along the border with China and North Korea that kind of did not succeed. But I think that what the world would like to see is that North Korea opens up economically and therefore exposes North Koreans more to Western styles of business operation. In other words, freedom to associate and workers' rights concepts would be a very good first step in that regard. They have a long way to go, but I don't know if that's happening very quickly. I mean, I think it's hopeful that some of these economic zones are being started up and there is a lot more market-oriented activity going on in North Korea. But again, a lot more needs to happen. I guess more to the point in answer to your question, I think the outside would like to see that happen inside North Korea. I think that it's a problem for Kim Jong-il because he wants to gain more stability economically as well, but the cost of that will be a relinquishing of power on his part because there will be a lot more exposure to these other kinds of corporate cultures that are not conforming with his own ways of doing business.
A question.
Hi, I enjoyed touring Carlton with you this
too.
Morning.
Good to see you.
I wanted to ask you, a lot of people have criticized the Bush administration for insisting on multilateral talks for disarmament. Do you think that if the Bush administration conceded and engaged in bilateral nuclear disarmament talks and conceded to Kim in that way, could we more effectively press the case for human rights in North Korea?
I'm not sure if that's necessarily true. I think that the talks have been stalled for so long. And at any rate, okay, so they're beginning again, that the bilateral discussions are actually happening. Chris Hill is meeting with his North Korean counterpart on the sidelines of the six-party talks. And frankly, I think that North Korea's hammering away at wanting bilateral talks with North Korea, with the U.S., is just yet another excuse for them not to come back to the table. I actually, in this instance, don't know if, the public appearance of saying that the U.S. will engage in a bilateral conversation with North Korea is going to be, again, yielding the outcomes that they are looking for. They have done things like that in the past, and North Korea, it's their negotiating style. They like to isolate. They don't like to be ganged up on. They prefer to act one-on-one, but they're not good players. They don't play well with others. And so keeping them in a multilateral setting, I think, and then having these one-on-one conversations with Hill on the sidelines of the multilateral larger discussion, I think is good for right now in this process.
Question?
There's one here in the
Hi. Do you think the introduction of a South Korean Secretary General for the UN has any potential for further or improved action by that global body?
I am really hopeful. Ban Ki-moon has said a couple of very promising things with regard to human rights in North Korea. He has to remember that he is no longer the foreign minister of South Korea. He is now the leader of the world's largest international agency, and as such needs to act in accordance with those precepts. He has he's publicly said that he thinks that a possible enlargening of the talks could be good, and that I take to mean human rights, economic development, and other areas of interest should also be talked about. Maybe not immediately in the context of the six-party talks, but just his saying that, I think, reflects where his mind is on this, and I think that's very positive. He just assumed his position, I guess, last month, and I look forward to seeing his progress on this issue.
Another question?
It's often said that the Chinese are really the only ones that have any influence over the North Koreans, but it seems they don't have that much influence either. Or at least there's a lot of things they can't get the North Koreans to do. Could you talk a little about that, what that relationship is, and how much influence the Chinese actually have?
China is North Korea's largest trading partner. They are the largest benefactor of food and fuel to North Korea. And many people say that China continues to prop up the Kim Jong-il regime because as annoying as he is to the Chinese government, he serves a purpose. in the geopolitical arena. And I think that China, everyone looks to China as being the key factor, and I actually think that they are the key factor. They haven't gone far enough, certainly not in terms of human rights. Sure, they have their own human rights problems, but if China hopes to become a world leader, it needs to behave in a way that is commensurate with that status, and part of that involves being a leader on human rights issues. Again, because China has, it's true, China has the most influence of over North Korea, but they weren't able to get North Korea not to test the nuclear weapon in October. So again, they find Kim Jong-il very annoying. But they aren't willing to take it to the next level of saying, we're going to completely cut you off. Because I think that China is trying to walk this fine line of not wanting a democratic, free, unified Korean peninsula on its borders that is allied with the United States, which is a long time in coming right now. But they don't want that to happen. North Korea serves as kind of a safe buffer state in that regard. They are allies, and China can always be looked upon to have this kind of influence over North Korea in these talks. So they're kind of perpetuating a situation, actually, I think.
Thank you, Ms. Liang Fenton.
Thank you. Thanks for coming.